Okay, you're welcome back to the 9 till noon show. An important message to get out there now, because cancer patients are being given false hope and putting themselves in danger due to Google search and other search engines, I'm sure. Google search and review results that allow alternative cancer clinics to draw people in, according to a review in the journal Nature. To discuss this and to warn of it, we're joined on the programme now by Professor Seamus O'Reilly, who's an oncologist at Cork University Hospital. Good morning to you, Professor. Thank you so much for your time.
Good morning. Thanks for asking me to join your programme, Con.
And I'm sure it's quite obvious what is happening here, because you can pay to have your to promote your results to be further up once someone searches for something. And I think in this day and age, whenever we have a diagnosis, how serious it is or not, the first thing often we do is go to Dr. Google, in inverted commas. What are we seeing, and what are your chief concerns, Seamus?
So our concerns is that we trust. The internet, we trust Google. When you Google these, when you go online and do journal searches, and if you look in the Financial Times at the weekend, over 90% of searches done on search engines on our computers are Google. So when you go online and you do searches, these clinics come up, and it's not clear that they're not conventional treatments, that they're alternative. There often include patient testimonies involved in it. And the clinics have a rating, there's a rating system there which doesn't distinguish between conventional clinic and alternative clinics. And people with cancer are vulnerable. Cancer is a lonely illness, and this is a time of extreme vulnerability for them. And they may have concerns about side effects of conventional therapy, or have had a family member who had a bad experience with cancer therapy. And that drives the pursuit of these alternative measures. And we know that for patients going, you know, where they abandon conventional therapy and they go to alternative therapy, that their mortality rate is greater. And that's a major concern.
It is. And look, we've seen with you know, Amazon Shopping, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, there's loads of examples whereby we're becoming more and more reliant and trusting on other people's experience. That can be the game changer that decides whether we eat in this restaurant or, unfortunately, in this case, whether we go down an alternative route for a very serious disease. And it's quite easy to manipulate ratings. So, you know, 4.8 out of 5, it's not hard to manufacture that if you were so wished, but also to flood reviews and what have you, you know, with fake reviews potentially. So you can see very easily how someone might get sucked into this, as you quite rightly point out, Seamus, at a very vulnerable time.
So, Greg, what we have suggested is that there would be guardrails on these search engines to protect vulnerable people, and there will be also more supervision of by the search engine companies who benefit financially from these searches of what the veracity of the claims made are. So last week, the US government sued Google for monopolizing search engine use, and we've seen where the UK governments in the UK and Ireland are concerned about the use about the social media companies and internet companies in terms of fostering dissent, and the riots that we've seen in Belfast, the riots in Dublin, the riots in cities in the United Kingdom. So these internet companies and social media companies have an enormous duty of care to society. I think sometimes we find in life that if shareholder value competes with patient outcomes, that shareholders will always win and patients will always lose. Mm. And this is another example of that. But long term, it's not a good thing for us not to trust the internet. I mean, it's our go-to source of information, as you said. So long term, if we have concerns or suspicions about its impact on our society and on our children, it'll fade off and it'll stop being used. And that would be a tremendous tragedy.
Yeah, and so really then it's in the interests of the likes of Google, the most popular search engine, to ensure that their results can be trusted. And, you know, I think there can be a conversation about social media's contribution to some of the events we've seen recently, and the argument over free speech and all that type of stuff. This is separate, though. This is about people's health, and I don't think these people should be collateral damage or victims of a wider conversation about social media's role in society. This should be a no-brainer. We shouldn't have to appeal to X or Google or anyone else to say, hold on a second, this is bad information. Other areas can be argued about, but we're very, very clear on the situation as it relates to cancer, I think. Is it useful for you, if you have examples, Professor, and maybe you don't, and maybe you don't think it is useful, to talk about some of the misinformation that is out there that people are encountering that's having this negative impact on their health and outcomes?
So in the article that was we published in relation to the Google paper that was from Caulfield and colleagues in the British Journal of Cancer Reports, we cite examples where patients have abandoned conventional therapy to pursue alternative therapy, and where the outcomes has been worse as a result. So this is something we're seeing in our practices on a regular basis. It's hugely distressing. Because you have patients in front of you where you know that they have potentially curable cancers, and we just can't get them to come around to accepting the treatments we're doing. We feel that they're hearing alternative voices. We're also in terms of their access to the internet, and some of that is medical professionals. Frankly, you know, so our community is guilty in this regard. We find that when we do searches, our searches are different. I've had patients outlining, you know, the remedies that they were pursuing. And when I've tried to search and find it on the internet, I haven't been able to. So the algorithms that they have, that they've developed over time, over years, are very different to my algorithms. And that's a worry that you go down a rabbit hole, and the rabbit hole becomes a catacomb. Yeah. But we have examples, and we've published examples, unfortunately, where patients have had poorer outcomes as a result of the pursuits of these therapies.
Yes, and this is in terms of treatment, but we're also seeing it in the area of prevention. The most common cancer in this country is skin cancer, and there is an awful lot of one of our greatest, you know, things that can protect us is sunscreen. And for some reason, someone is trying to drive this narrative that it's actually sunscreen that is what's harming you. And some people will go, especially those maybe who feel like disenfranchised or whatever it might be, some might go, well, that suits my life. I'm not going to use sunscreen because I read it somewhere. So it's not just in the treatment, but we're always also seeing this misinformation out there in terms of the prevention.
Yes, and we saw it as well during the COVID pandemic, where people were reluctant about vaccines. And there was this myth of big pharma, but that's out there in the community as well. But certainly the commonest cancer we see in Ireland, because of our Celtic heritage, is skin cancer. We know that sunscreen is endorsed by multiple agencies worldwide and by the Irish Cancer Society in terms of their cancer prevention program as a way of reducing that. As we get older, we're more likely to develop these cancers. So as our society ages and as we have increased in life expectancy, this is going to become more and more of an issue in the decades ahead.
Yeah, and I can't imagine what it must be like to sit in front of a patient who's decided to, you know, abandon curative cancer therapy that will potentially therapies that might cure them, and opting for a treatment plan that's not evidence-based and is based on a couple of Google reviews or a lot of Google reviews that you can't really check the authenticity of. It could be AI wrote them, for all we know.
So, I mean, when these situations happen, they're relatively rare, but they do occur. We all have examples of it in our practice as oncologists. And part of it is finding out where the medical mistrust comes from as regards the decision-making. Part of it is also establishing, is there coercive control by a family member or a well-meaning relative, where they're endorsing these strategies and engaging in a negative way. In terms of conventional medicine.
That's really is quite interesting, because a couple of cases spring to mind in that regard. So it is actually a reality in some cases. Thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Professor Seamus O'Reilly, take care of yourself. He is an oncologist at Cork University Hospital. Now, just to give you an example, there's a study that came out in 2018, and I want to decouple this from the COVID stuff, if that's all right. No disrespect to the professor there, but there were different schools of thought on the approach and treatment plans for COVID, and there are still very significant differences there. So personally, if it were me, I would actually decouple it from that, because that's an area where arguably we're still learning. There are different medical points of view. I'm not in any way calling out the professor there, completely separate to that conversation. But here, what we do have is we have cancer for many, many years with many, many people who are working very hard to give us our best outcomes. And there are therapies that are proven to work. We know that in our own families. But what is happening is some are, maybe they are disenfranchised, or they don't have a trust of medical, of medicine. And maybe it is for that reason. Well, sure, if you can't trust them on that, how can we trust them on this? But I would really discourage anyone from Googling and going down the alternative route. Maybe it's something you can run alongside your traditional medicine if you want to, or in consultant with your consultant. But a 2018 study from the Yale School of Medicine found patients who subscribe to alternative therapies are twice as likely to die in the same period as those who rely on conventional therapies. There's another story of a lady who says, my husband went there twice. This is a review of one of these clinics. My husband went there twice. The second time, they told me he was cancer-free and they sent him home. He was not cancer-free. It had even spread to his liver and bones. So as I say, if you're a bit cautious about the area of medicine, I think in terms of I think in terms of cancer treatments, we probably should have trust there. Let me see. There was one came in there about, where is it? We all know that alternative medicine treatment does actually work for some people. So no point in saying all alternative treatments are bad. We all know that chemotherapy does not work in all people, yet we are not suggesting that we do not use it. A bit of common sense is needed and freedom of all information. Okay, if that's what you think. So are you of the view, and it's important, this texter, really, I think, just to see where you're at. Like, are you saying that, God forbid, you got a diagnosis of cancer? Or maybe you did, so I really don't want to be disrespectful. Are you saying that we should leave it just to the hands of the public, where there's clinics that we don't know how truthful the reviews are or what have you, that we should just let people, without any alternative information, we should let people themselves decide whether it's conventional conventional medicine or something they've read on Google? Like, do you believe that we should, and maybe it was your experience, maybe there's someone out there through alternative medicine was cancer-free. But, I mean, we do have a responsibility here as well, that it, because there's vested interests. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in someone, and they might not care for the outcome of the person. There's a lot of money to be made in saying, you know, don't do that, do this. They get the money out of you, and you're not there to complain because you potentially have passed away. The sister of the murdered Tyrone schoolgirl, Arlene Arkinson, has called for a public inquiry into the handling of the case on the 30th anniversary of her disappearance. You would know, and it's been covered extensively on this radio station. Arlene was 15 years of age when she went missing after a night out at a disco in Bundoran on the 13th of August 1994. From Castlederg, she was last seen in a car driven by convicted murderer and rapist Robert Howard. A solicitor for Arlene Arkinson's family is Des Doherty, and Des is with me now. Des, thank you for your time.
No problem at all. I really appreciate the support and the fact that you've reported on this case widely over the last number of years.
It must be incredibly difficult for the family. So many unanswered questions. Still sign of Arlene Arkinson's remains, no place to go. And I suppose, like we've become accustomed to, visit a grave or you know, mourn in that way. So much that makes this so difficult for all of the family, Des. Can you give us a sense of that?
Yes, well, it's an emotional and a legal void at the moment for the family. It is absolutely terrible what they have gone through and effectively the way they have been treated by the state in this jurisdiction. And that goes back to 1994. And even by the standards of 1994, the family were treated appallingly then. And the fact that Howard, who was out on bail, he should never have been out on bail at the time, then goes and effectively kidnaps Arlene and murders her, should never have happened because he should never have been out on bail. And then, because Arlene's case was dealt with so dreadfully, this man then was able to go ahead and murder a 14-year-old child in London. If that was to happen in this day and age now, there would be a massive public outcry and there would be calls for all sorts of investigations and inquiries. And unfortunately, we do see in a number of cases in the media that then they're looked back upon and they're looked at all the failings and everything that happened. But from day one, the Arkinson family were treated abysmally by the state, effectively, which is now hard to believe that the event was 30 years ago. But it is, I suppose, today an emotional event in terms of there's a vigil later today in Castle Derrick at 6 p.m. And I think after that, the legal case in relation to the case will commence again. But mm-hmm. it's a very emotional time at the moment. And as you've said there, there's never been a body discovered, despite many searches and, in fairness, carried out by the Garda and by the police and recently by the Garda as well. And I think one of the main aims that Kathleen always had was to have a proper Christian burial for her sister. And the other thing I would say, we're constantly fed a news feed of trauma every single day. Now we turn on our phones or look at the television screens. And it's very, very difficult for the case of a 15-year-old child from 30 years ago to get any sort of attention. But there is a chord struck within the public in this case because people really cannot believe how bad the family has been treated.
Des, as we mentioned, in 2021, an inquest found Arlene was murdered by Robert Howard. Is that a finding that the family do accept? I think you indicated really in your commentary there that they must.
Yes, they do. In fact, that the achievement, the major achievement of the inquest was opened by the late John Leckie, coroner, in 2001. We had 40 preliminary hearings. We finally got the hearings underway. The state effectively tried to collapse the inquest because they brought in public interest immunity certificates, all the sorts of mechanisms that they use in legacy cases and so-called either terrorist or paramilitary cases. And it was all brought in a case involving a 15-year-old child, which, of course, caused great suspicion and consternation. So we don't have the findings until 2021. But on that day of the findings, that was the first time had judicial confirmation that Howard was the killer. And that was that was a major achievement, and it was met with much positivity from the family to have that recognition. Because the finger of blame had been pointed at them at one stage, because you will recall that another informant, another state agent, effectively, and taken the light of suspicion off Howard, pointed the finger of suspicion towards the family, and that the RUC and the British Army turned up at their home and began to dig up their garden and invited the media along. I mean, again, to put it into context, that was back in the 90s. Can you imagine that happening now in this day and age? Yeah. It would just be totally horrific, and the effects of it and the criticisms of it. So again, it's just another example of how badly the family were treated.
There's often when there is a call for a public inquiry, part of the argument for it is that, you know, to make sure something like this can never happen again. And on two occasions there, you've referenced that thankfully as a society we've moved forward whereby we can't imagine something like this happening again. So this then really is, I suppose, about, you know, justice or answers or accountability for the family. And correct me if I'm wrong in relation to that. So what might a public inquiry achieve that would satisfy the family, if that makes sense?
Well, that argument about that in this day and age, it might not ever happen again. I remember that discussion with the Justice Minister at the time in November 2021. And it had been around about the time of, you may recall, the Sarah Everard case. Mm-hmm. And I pointed out, I said, no, well, these things do happen again. Is it in broad daylight? Mm-hmm. Not only in Britain, but in Ireland as well. This is the case here as well. So what we have to do is learn the lessons and the mistakes and the failures that have been made before to try to ensure that it doesn't happen again, because there's no guarantee it will not happen again. But you have to try and learn from it and learn from your mistakes. And that's really, I suppose, be one of the main goals. You need to look at the failings of the police in the legal system towards the Arkansas family. And you can't just simply shrug your shoulders and say, oh, well, it was in the 90s, it was 1994, we were leading up to the ceasefires and, you know, with other things to do. Or you can't fall into the trap either of arguing with Saudi police investigation. And, you know, it's just one of those things and you should just move on. Yeah. You can't say that because there is a wider picture which deals with, and I've heard other journalists speaking about it as well, about violence towards children and towards women in particular and how it's dealt with by the police and by the courts. Because, we are in a different society now, of course, yes. But the mid-90s, I know it's 2 years ago, but I'm sure for yourself and myself, it doesn't feel that far away.
No,
you know, in some ways it feels, you know, we can still remember. So even by the standards of the time, and I know with distancing and looking back, I have now realised in a lot of long cases I've been involved in, it can be a good and a positive thing. Mm-hmm. But even with distancing and looking back, by the standards of the 90s, and we're talking about the mid to the late 90s, this was still appalling. And then even leading up to, you know, 2005 when there was a trial, even everything within the legal system was appalling then. So it's not that long ago. It'll never be perfect that everything will be okay and this will never happen again. I don't think we can ever say that because there have been a lot of recent cases. And unfortunately, there will be more, but lessons must be learnt. That's the point.
Justice Minister Naomi Long says there's not sufficient grounds for a public inquiry. But, I mean, the grounds, you'd imagine the grounds would be discovered very early in the process of a public inquiry, if that makes sense.
Well, and fairness to the Justice Minister, who was quite courteous towards the family, we did meet with her. That, her statement is now out of context, unfortunately. And she'll probably realise that herself because the findings of the inquest were in 2021. We met with the Justice Minister in November 21. She then, I think, in my respectful view for what it's worth, but I believe she rushed her decision. But she made her decision before February 2022, but then Stormont collapsed. So that decision that she's talking about was made quite some time ago. So we had no way of returning to her and engaging with her and saying, look, you may want to reconsider this and because of that. Stormont collapsed. The family then, once again, are left in a legal void. They have nowhere to go. They have no justice minister to challenge. They can't judicially review. They had to wait until Stormont got back up and running again, and it was very, very difficult for them.
Yeah.
Stormont only got back up and running again recently. So the family made the emotional decision, really, to not engage in a legal process until after the 30th anniversary. And so now the 30th anniversary, obviously today, they're going to pursue that again. Okay. So the decision made after she made some time ago, there has been a series of documentaries made. One, and a lot of investigative journalism, which has really promoted this case, mm-hmm. with the Murder in the Badlands series and the BBC, the TG4 documentary as well. And Sky have recently completed their filming because we've all been interviewed for another documentary mm-hmm. that's to be broadcast in October and November. And the Murder in the Badlands documentary was in the top 10 in America. It became internationally very popular because people were aghast at the case. And so it's garnered a lot of support.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, sometimes
not to hold the public inquiry.
It looks at it afresh because even you or I have covered it here. Obviously, you've been at the forefront of this. But sometimes, when you present the facts to people who aren't aware of it, as like an international audience, they see it somewhat differently and can see the gaps and the problems that perhaps the authorities in this country either don't see or are ignoring. Des, if you happen to be speaking to the family, please pass on our best wishes at this very difficult time. And I'm sure difficult times between anniversaries and birthdays and Christmases, they come around many times a year. But this is another one. So pass on our best wishes. And thanks, Des, for speaking with us.
No, thank you very much. Thank you.
Des Doherty, solicitor for Arlene Arkinson's family. Hilary on Facebook says, why discourage alternative therapies? Well, I'll read the rest of your comment, Hilary, but I'm not discouraging them, sorry. I just would be anyone close to me if they went to see a consultant and the consultant says, right, we've a chance of getting you cured with these conventional therapies, be that radiation or whatever it might be, And someone close to me says, right, I'm not doing that. Instead, I'm going to try this alternative. I would find that problematic. Obviously, it's up to the individual to make their own choice, and it always is the case. What I said was alternatives, of course, you can explore them. Hopefully, they could work alongside traditional therapies. But if your consultant says, you know, we've got a good chance of curing you, and you say, no, I'm not doing that, I'm only doing alternative, that's what I was talking about. I'd be concerned if people completely gave up on traditional medicine, in inverted commas, traditional, that could be misinterpreted, you know what I mean, versus the alternatives. If it were me, I think if I would go down I certainly would engage with a consultant to go down the traditional route. I probably would also seeing if there's anything that could complement that in the alternative therapy space as well. But that would be my own personal decision. So I'm not poo-pooing alternative therapies. I've not enough knowledge of it. I would have my concerns if it was driven by Google and fake Google reviews, potentially, that someone chose that option over the conventional therapies that are there. Hilary said, I'll read your comment in full. I disagree. Alternative therapies work for many people. I never said they didn't, by the way. Sorry if I come across as saying so. And then she says, yes, the vested interest is from the multimillion pharmaceutical companies. Look, we are a product to all of them. You know, big pharma, government, whatever, we're a product. But the alternatives, the alternative voices in different spaces, trust me, we are a product to them as well. And a case in point, last night, as I said earlier on, two billionaires, people that will never have to have money, that have enough money to wipe out hunger between them in a country. That's how much money they have, sitting patting their backs, talking about us as a product, really. They don't care about us. They're billionaires. They care about protecting. Elon Musk doesn't want oil to be used for 500 years. He's the biggest player in the EV market. You know, Donald Trump wanting oil to be burnt for 500 years. He wants to get elected for 4 years, not discussing the potential consequences of the quality of the air that we breathe and so on. So those people, I'm not saying they're the alternative voices, but trust me, we're products to them as well. That's all we are. And if they're telling us nonsense on Twitter, X, or Facebook, or particularly Twitter and the likes of a Lawrence Fox, for example, would be an alternative voice. He literally posts the checks he gets from X as if to say, keep hating me, this is the amount of money I'm making. We are a product to all of them. The truth lies somewhere in between. And I have in front of me a book. It's called A Riot in Murphy's Pub. Its author is Irene Murlock, and I have Irene in the studio with me. Hi, Irene.
Hello.
How are you keeping?
I'm doing well, thank you very
and
much.
And smelling fantastic, if you don't mind me saying.
Sorry?
Smelling fantastic. I don't know what perfume you use, but it's absolutely beautiful. Irene, congratulations on the publication of your book.
Thank you very much.
This is, is it too far to say that it is a lifelong dream to have your own book published?
Yes, I always wanted to write a book, but only just got around it. I'm a slow starter.
Okay. Well, let's learn a little bit about you. You're originally from the Brandywell area, but you've been living in Moth in Donegal, not a million miles away, for the last couple of decades.
Yes, that's right. I love Moth.
Yeah, okay. And that's your home now?
That's my home.
But still a dairy girl? Still a dairy girl?
Oh, well, you're always a dairy girl. Okay. And if you're not born in Moth, you're always a blow-in.
Exactly, that's true. Come here, when did this dream of writing a book first start for you?
I suppose I always wanted to write from a very young age, teenager probably. But I didn't have any formal education, so I just assumed that I couldn't write. You know, I thought you needed a degree to write.
Yeah.
I didn't know you could actually do it without going to university. And then I started writing comedy sketches. I was in an all-women's comedy group called Stretch Marks Unlimited.
Love it.
And we all wrote sketches each, you know, we took turns. So I just figured, well, that's a story with a beginning, a middle and an end, even if it's a very short story.
Yeah.
After 2 years of doing that, I started to write plays. And it were quite successful plays.
So you were scratching the artistic writing itch for quite some time.
Yeah. But my ambition was to write a book.
But still, the book eluded you. Why?
I don't know. I think I just thought it would be too hard, too complicated to do that. There's so much goes into a book. But you know, when I started writing it, that wasn't the case at all. It came very natural.
Mm. Do you kick yourself that you didn't?
I do.
Yeah. Well, you were very busy raising a family.
Yeah.
And everything else that goes along with it. You know, in a traditional family sense, in that, you know, where, what is that? But you know what I mean? The day-to-day grind is what I'm on about. That sounds terrible. But do you know the challenge of raising a family? It's like you've got one up where they're less responsible, and then another one where they still rely on you, and then there's one coming behind. It's hard to find the time, isn't it? Maybe we should make time better, but it can be hard to find the time for ourselves sometimes.
It is hard to make time when I had four children of my own, you know, I was divorced, so it was a full-on job for me. And then gradually as they became more independent and, you know, they didn't need me as much, I was thinking to myself, well, what am I going to do now, you know?
Yeah.
Do I still have a brain, or is it gone to mush after all these years of housework? So I decided to try, and that's when I got on the sketch writing. But it took me a long time to get to the book.
Yeah, but you see, there's probably a school of thought, I'm not sure if you share it, Irene, that, you know, maybe now was the right time. You talked about when you actually started, it was easier than you had anticipated, but maybe you were formed as the person that you are, and now was the time for you to do it to the best of your ability.
I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. Probably that's very true. But it would be nice if I could have started younger. But it doesn't matter. I'm here now, so
exactly.
And it's done now.
So how did you get into the comedy sketching? Why were you writing comedy? Is that just what you were drawn to, what you had the knack for?
I've always loved comedy.
Yeah.
I've actually done stand-up and all, and I just love comedy. So I find it very uplifting. I think to write something very deep, I wouldn't enjoy it as much.
Mm-hmm.
I've always loved comedy.
I would listen to a number of podcasts and I've done a number of interviews, and I always think in terms of performance or what have you, comedy is the most difficult. You know, you listen to comedies that have gone up to that go up to do the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, and it's a nightmare, you know, or they're trying new work and they're playing small clubs and it can be in front of five or six people. It just seems a really, really tough way to make money as a comedian. Or to make a living, or even to have fun.
That's right. It is very hard. And the scariest thing that I ever done in my life was stand-up comedy.
Mm.
I mean, it was terrifying.
There's no safety in that.
No. You go out there and everybody's looking up at me and saying, entertain me now, you know, so you just hope that it works out. So that was the most frightening thing. Writing the book, as I said, it seemed to come naturally to me.
Yeah.
So I was very lucky in that respect. Mm. You know.
Just one other question, just on your stand-up work. Did you do that a couple of times just to prove yourself you could do it, or did you do the circuit, or what?
No, I did it in the group that I was in, the Stretch Marks Unlimited. We had a spot where I did stand-up comedy, and I've done it at all the places, like weddings and places like that, you know, but it's very, very hard to do.
So much pressure.
If it works, it's great.
Yeah.
You know, it's the best thing in the world, but if it doesn't, you know, it's soul destroying.
Yeah, if you have a stinker, it's a nightmare. Right, so this is a new work. It's called A Riot in Murphy's Pub. It's a new work, but does it have its foundation or even the basis of the story in previous writings?
It's very, very loosely based on a play. You know, that's where it came from. And it's a black comedy, you know, I need to say that. So it is based on, very loosely based on the play. So I had the bones of it already.
Yeah. Okay. And it's very accessible. It's not you know, it's not 300 pages here. Is that what you wanted? That you wanted something? I mean, I would say proper avid readers could probably pick this up and spurt out in one sitting almost.
Or, yeah, that's right.
You know,
that's
is that what you wanted?
That's what I wanted. I didn't want a long drawn out story, because I do get bored myself if I'm reading the book and it's too long.
There's too much filler.
And I like plenty of things happening in a story, and you don't often get that, you know. So there's a lot of mayhem in that book, you know. If you
pack a lot in.
A lot of characters,
yeah.
And a lot of them taken from my own life, so they're really real.
Yeah, I get you. It's a sort of a mishmash and a pull in all different types of people. Mm-hmm. Now, you never know. It's like a stand-up gig. You never know what it's going to be like until you get the reaction, okay? So you, this has been published primarily on Amazon, is it?
It's an Amazon, but it's also in America. No, it was published by Pegasus.
Okay, right, so you have a publisher.
Yeah, they're a publisher.
But the reaction to it's been really positive.
It's getting great reviews on Amazon. Really, there's people looking for sequels.
Well, that's one of my questions, so we'll brush over that. What does that feel like, though, when you put it out there? And, you know, the thing with Amazon, it's global. So someone could be picking this up in Indianapolis or India or in Hollywood in Belfast. You know, the fact that you're getting positive reviews from all over the place, it must be very encouraging.
It's lovely, to tell you the truth. I really am enjoying that. And the book's actually on sale in Barnes & Noble.
Brilliant.
And America and Walmart. And,
wow.
And Amazon over there. And I've also adapted it onto a film script. So I'm looking for Colin Farrell, but I can't get him anywhere.
You're looking for Colin Farrell to pay the part where you come and did an interview about it. Colin Farrell, you want me? You're asking Colin Farrell to play me. Is that it? No?
Absolutely.
Now, come here. Tell us the story of the outline as much as you want without, right. you know yourself how much you can say. So the picture, for those of you watching, it is a familiar Irish picture, you could almost say. It's a coffin with a pint on top and a cap on top. And it's called A Riot in Murphy's Pub. What's the story?
The story is about a man called Higgs, which is short for Hegarty. Who loves being in the pub. He's in the pub almost every night of the week, and his wife's very neglected. So they have no family, no children, no relatives. So he comes home one night, and he thinks it's Friday night, but it's actually the early hours of Sunday morning. So she just cracks up, and she kills him, and she's put in jail straight away. So there's nobody to wake him. They've no family, they've no children. And all the wives in the village will have nothing to do with waking him. They've totally disowned him. So the men are just really outraged about this, and they have a big party in the bar, and they celebrate his life. Now, he's lying in the chapel, lying in state, waiting to get buried. They have a great night at the big do. But the next day, everybody's hungover, and then the police come to the door looking to see who stole Higgs' body from the chapel. So that's as far as I can go with.
What a setup.
I know.
What a setup.
Just sort of a whodunit.
Brilliant. And also to adapt it for as a film script as well, it sounds like, you know, it might not be a dream the likes of a Colin Farrell could be in this.
There's a couple of you've read the reviews. Some people in Amazon reviewing it says it sounds like a film to them.
Yeah.
It reads like a film, you know, so.
And Camille, why do you think it's been so popular in America? Is it the Irish angle, do you think?
Oh, yes, there's so many Irish.
Yeah.
And even people that aren't Irish, they'll tell you they are Irish, you know.
I know, exactly.
Because I was in Las Vegas one time with my son, and there was a man, bartender, who was obviously a black man, you know. And he says, "Where are you all from?" And I says, "I'm from Ireland." He says, "Oh, my granny was from Cork."
There you go.
And that happens no matter where you go in America. Somebody's always an Irish descent, you know.
And Camille, you talk about the your fans looking for a sequel. What is the situation there, Irene? Because, you know, you when you left school at 14, I think a lot of it you maybe didn't back yourself throughout your entire life, but you did eventually and you got here now. Do you want to rest at that and say, right, I've fulfilled my lifelong dream, there is a book, or are you scratching now? Have you an itch to scratch about getting something else out?
I have two more books written.
Wow.
And the publisher likes them.
Excellent.
But I'm finding this a very different process from playwriting, because in playwriting you write the play and then you get the actors and then you do the rehearsing and then you're on the stage. So it's all congealed and you know where you're going. With publishing, you're sort of waiting around.
Yeah.
You know, what's happening now? Because you can't do anything yourself. You have to wait for the publisher.
And do they send it back to you and go, "We love it, but..." Or, like, I'm not looking for specific examples or anything. I'm just, the process interests me. They might go, "Oh, we love that, but what about this?"
They never changed one word.
Wow.
Not a word. And I was surprised, because there's some very risky words in that book, you know. No, they never changed a thing, which was great.
Excellent. All right, listen, congratulations. I think fans will be delighted to know there's another couple of books at least in the offing. And you're just enjoying it now, are you?
I'm having a ball. just let me say that the books will be in Little Acorn Bookshop in Derry.
Yes.
And also Foyle Bookshop in Magazine Street. They're not there yet at the minute, but they're ordered, they're a bit slow coming in.
Fantastic. And you can't... Would you be a... You'd be a big reader yourself, would you?
All my life.
Yeah, and do you still like picking up the actual book and turning down the corner, or would you take a Kindle on holidays with you, or what?
No, I like a book.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are like that.
There's nothing like a book.
I think a lot of people thought the digital stuff would be like vinyl, that vinyl would, you know, like a actual book would become niche, but readers don't want that. They find it handy to take a few books with them on holiday, but fundamentally, when it comes down to it, they want to get a good book in their hand and get a smell of it.
Absolutely. Well, you know yourself, you're probably a reader too. There's nothing like holding the book and reading it. Than an electric device is not the same at all.
All right, Irene, listen, I can't wait to see where this goes. It'd be fantastic if it was turned into a film. There's so many options now as well too, because, you know, back in the day there could have been three or four, you know, film houses or whatever, but now you've got Amazon, you've got Netflix, you've got Apple. Who's to say, you know, where this could go?
That's great. But here's the problem. It's very hard to get your foot in the door.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Yeah. You know, it's getting in there.
Exactly.
I know it would make a great film, but it depends on who wants to do that.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah. Because it's proven, because the book works and you've got the screenplay and everything. And do you still write for the stage a little bit, or is it sort of a work-life balance and the work is the book and the life is stuff outside the arts?
When COVID happened, you know, everything, you know yourself what happened. I never got back to this. I have two more plays written, which were never staged.
Right.
Wrote those during COVID. So I might go back. I haven't decided.
Wow. So you've got a good body of work sitting there ready to go between books and stage. Fantastic. All right, brilliant stuff, Irene. Any advice, by the way, for someone 14, 24, who has a dream that you've learned from your experience that by your own account, you know, it's taken quite some time for you to fulfil that dream? Have you any advice for anyone out there with a dream that maybe they're... themselves are holding them back, or whatever it might be?
I think you need to believe in yourself. That's the most important
back
thing.
Back yourself.
You need to believe in yourself. And just don't give up. Look at me. I'm ancient.
You're incredibly successful. But no, I do take your point. You're not ancient, but I do take your point. But then again, you could argue, when is something late or too late? It's not really, because we're sitting here having a chat about it.
That's right.
And it's there for good. All right, Irene, lovely to have you in studio. The very best of luck in getting this to the screen. I'd love to see that. And the publication of the next two books, sequels? Or
no, they're not. They're
just complete
different.
New works. Yeah. Fantastic.
Comedies, but completely different.
All right, great stuff. All right, Arlene Murlock, author of A Riot in Murphy's Pub. You can get it on Amazon. And do you want to quickly one time again mention those bookstores that will be coming into supply soon?
Little Acorns Bookstore in Great James's Street in Derry, and Foyle Bookshop and Magazine Street in Derry.
All right, and there is the cover. If you're flicking through Amazon and you want to make sure you got the right one, it is called A Riot in Murphy's Pub. Irene, thank you so very much indeed. It's been wonderful having you on the programme.
Thank you.
Back with more shortly. I want to mention a quiz that we have running for you. It's in advance of National Heritage Week. It's running from the 17th of August to the 25th. And on the show today, we've got two family heritage cards valued at €90 each to give away. And these cards offer access for a family, that's two adults and up to five kids, to over 45 OPW managed heritage sites across the country. So you can bring a random five children with you as well, of course. You can visit any or all of the attractions as often as you like during the heritage card's validity period. You can see heritageweek.ie for all events listings for Donegal and further afield. Now, to win, which heritage place am I talking about right now? Sitting beside Garton, so peaceful and so still, a house and garden given to us by the artist Derek Hill. It's a bit challenging, this. I think, I don't know, would people have this in their general knowledge bank? I might not, honestly. You might have to Google it. But anyway, give us the answer. Send it via WhatsApp or text to 086 60 25,000. Tell us who you are, where you're from. Or you can email it to comments@highlandradio.com. So, sitting beside Garton, so peaceful and so still, a house and garden given to us by the artist Derek Hill. What house and facility are we talking about? Heritageweek.ie is the place to find all events for National Heritage Week happening in County Donegal, but also across the country if you're away visiting and you're into that type of thing, or maybe you could get into that type of thing. Right, okay. Stuart, you've asked a question. Why is Ireland not being given being more active in relation to Palestine. Can you make your point in a couple of minutes, or do you want to come back on with us tomorrow?
Oh, I can give you a couple of minutes now.
Yeah, go ahead, Stuart. It's an important issue, and I don't want you to feel that I'm rushing it, but we have a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
No, I just feel that, I don't know if everybody knows, because our mainstream media, as you know and everybody else knows, is very quality control, and you're only allowed to say so much, and they don't report half of what's going on.
Israel good, Russia bad, that type of thing.
Yes. Well, Shannon Airport, people don't realise that when the Iraqi war was going on, we had over 900,000 American troops going through there per year. But people don't know that happened. And our government needs to stop immediate effect anything American is coming in that isn't tourists. No refueling these planes because they're not checked. Nobody knows what's on board. They can bring bombs as long as they're not active bombs.
There were rendition flights as well, let's not forget either. People being taken to Guantanamo Bay, I believe, there was stop off for refueling in Shannon. Maybe the Irish people don't want to be complicit in that.
We are complicit. This is the problem. We are involved. If we are fueling planes for America, we are involved in this. Our Taoiseach went out there and done his best on St. Patrick's Day. I disagreed with anybody going out, but to be fair, he done his best, and you could see in his face the disgust. He just completely, what he said, the America turned around and just said the complete opposite. And the other thing is, our airspace should be closed to all American military, army, and our coasts need to be closed to the American Navy. They're all sitting out now ready for, they're poking and poking and poking at Iraq or Iran, hoping that eventually they're going to give in and there's going to be an all-out hell broke loose. And that's what Israel's looking to do. And they are, Israel's at war at the minute with four different countries.
Yeah. All right,
they're not allowed to defend themselves. Only Israel's allowed to defend themselves.
Yeah, well, Stuart, look at
that. And they're not allowed.
I'd love to actually tease out the conversation with you and counterpoints and get to where we want to get to. But unfortunately, time has run out. But we'll get back to it again, Stuart. It is an important issue.
Our airports. Close them for American troops and that. But there are consequences.
There's consequences to that. But anyway, I take your point. And listen, what's happening in Palestine is such that we should be outraged on an hourly basis, not just
daily. Every day it needs to be talked about.
All right, Stuart, have a good day. Appreciate it. I feel bad rushing you, but I explained at the beginning, so I hope you understand. Take care of yourself. That's where we have to leave it on the show today. We will, Tuesday's winner, Glebe House is the answer. Well done, Niamh McFadden, Kilcar, Glebe Gallery, Martina Cush in Ruski Convoy. Both of you will be in touch with your passes. Thank you for that. Back with another chance to win and so much more besides tomorrow after 9:00.